15 minutes, say a little bit about black holes, and then try to cap off the sort of general tour, and then let's move on to FRW Spacetime. So some of the quantitative details of getting about you know just a little quantitative introduction to the black hole metrics is what will be covered in the tutorial this afternoon. But maybe I'll just sketch a few things. The point here is just to understand how all these metrics relate to one another. In particular, you know, so the Schwarzschild metric, this guy, so unlike the previous metrics, I don't describe in the notes how to derive this metric. This one is quite straightforward to derive. I didn't do it because I think so. There's a better way. You know, going through the sort of turning the crank that we have previously turned, where you take the metric, calculate the inverse, calculate all the Christoffel symbols, and then use those to calculate the Riemann tensor and then the Ricci tensor. So that is not the best. You can do that. I mean, you can do that by hand. It won't take too long, but it's definitely not the best way to do it. And I think Ruth Gregory is teaching you a better way to do this, probably in her class. And who knows? Maybe she's even already done it. Is that okay? Great. Yeah. So anyway, I'll just say the briefest bit about, you know. So the idea is that this metric describes the space-time around a non-spinning, time-independent black hole. So just roughly speaking, and furthermore, it describes the space-time outside the surface of any star of non-spinning, time-independent star of mass M. Just the vacuum solution outside of that is also given by this same formula. You just have to stop using this formula once R gets to be less than the radius of the star that you're talking about. Once you get inside some star, then the metric begins to look different. But if you cram that star within this critical radius, so you see there's some critical radius at which this metric begins to look weird. So if R becomes less, if when R becomes equal to 2gm, then this coefficient vanishes. This coefficient goes to infinity, so that special radius is called the Schwarzschild radius. And yeah, if you take your star that's described by this metric, but you cram all of the matter, you cram its surface entirely inside this radius, then it can't sustain itself. It collapses to a singularity at the center of the metric. That's this thing we call black hole. So then what is going on for the black hole at R equals the Schwarzschild radius? So the first thing is that the metric looks singular there. In other words, it looks like some eigenvalues are going to zero and some eigenvalues are going to infinity. But that's just a coordinate thing. It turns out if you calculate invariant quantities, if you calculate, so, for example, the Ricci scalar, something that doesn't depend on the coordinates that you choose, these things don't blow up at R equals R, at R equals the Schwarzschild radius.
The Ricci scalar is not a good measure in this case.
Because that's true. Well, so but the point is just to say that nothing you calculate goes to infinity. That's the key thing. So the typical sign that you're actually dealing with an honest to God's a physical singularity in the space-time, not just a coordinate singularity, is that there's some curvature tensor. Usually the fact is that some curvature tensor or combination of curvature tensors you can find that is a coordinate invariant object that blows up regardless of coordinates. So nothing does that at the Schwarzschild radius. And more explicitly, you can find different coordinates which are just perfectly smooth and pass right through the Schwarzschild radius. These coordinates don't really make sense. It's probably not a good idea to really think about these coordinates as describing the space-time inside of r equals the Schwarzschild radius. But that said, these coordinates do, the curvature does blow up at r equals 0 if you calculate it for this metric. And that's a real thing. There really is an honest-to-God curvature singularity at the center of this space-time. Maybe just one final thing to say about it is that, you know, if you just want to see very simply, kind of, let's say, for example, that you remembered that the metric looked something like this, but you couldn't remember was this factor to the plus one and this one was to the minus one or vice versa. You wanted to extract the most basic piece of physics about this metric. You can ask. Let me imagine starting from radius that starting from some radius r, which let's assume we're talking about some radius bigger than the Schwarzschild radius. That I send a photon outwards. I just send a photon radially outwards. So photons travel along paths with ds squared is equal to zero. So, and I'm sending it in the radial direction, so I can just neglect this bit. So if I set 0 is equal to this stuff and solve, you know, I get 1 minus 2gm over r dt squared is equal to 1 minus 2gm over r minus 1 dr squared. And so if I bring the dt squared over here, and I bring this factor over here, so this becomes squared. And now let me just take the square root. The square root, there's a plus or minus sign, but I'm talking about sending a photon outwards, so what I want is the plus sign. Right, I want dr dt to be positive. When r is greater than 2gm, this thing is positive, so I take the plus root. And so what this says is that okay, so although the physical velocity relative to an observer who locally uses Minkowski-like coordinates, flat coordinates in his vicinity, he will always say that the photon passes by at the speed of light. But in these coordinates, in the RT coordinates that in which the metric takes this simple form, you know, what you see is that as I release the photon from R closer and closer to 2gm, as I take the radius in and in towards the Schwarzschild radius, so that this term goes to zero from the positive side, dr dt gets smaller and smaller until, as I reach the point where r equals 2gm, the dr dt is zero. So I release the photon, but it just sits at r equals 2gm forever. Dr dt is zero. Okay, so this is saying, you know, this is one way of seeing that's where the event horizon is. It's the point where you try your best to send a signal out to infinity. And it just it's right at the threshold where it just loiters there forever. Now the Kerr black hole, I just want to say, here I really can't derive it for you using elementary methods. But you got to know about it because it's so awesome. So we've been sort of taking steps from most symmetric down to less and less symmetric metrics. So in Minkowski space, in four-dimensional Minkowski space, you know, how many symmetries does that have? Well, an observer can rotate around any of three different directions. So that's three, and then he can make a boost in any of three different directions, and the space-time looks the same to him. And then he can also translate. You know, an observer who's translated either you know, an observer here versus an observer who's just sitting at a space-time at the later time, they see identical space-times around them, or an observer who's sitting at the origin versus another observer at a different point in space, they have no way to tell that the space-time around them looks identical. Every measurement they make about the space-time around them will yield identical answers. So there's four more here. So there's 10 symmetries, and in fact, if you all the n-dimensional maximally symmetric metrics, if you think about the k equals plus or minus one construction that we did, it was built from two equations that both that were both invariant. Both the metric and the embedding spacetime let me go back to my other notation where I used capital A's to run over all five indices just to make things shorter here. So you can check that if you make the substitution XA is equal to some matrix lambda AB, some constant matrix times X twiddle B, if I make some linear coordinate transformation like that, then both of these equations will be invariant, will just be completely unchanged by that substitution, except that the X's will be replaced by X twiddles, if A to AB is invariant under that substitution. So in other words, A to AB is equal to, A to AB, lambda A, C, lambda B, D is equal to A to CD. But in the de Sitter case, this was the metric with signature 4, 1. And in the anti-de Sitter case, this was the metric with signature 3, 2. And the set of matrices that have this property, that they preserve the flat metric with that signature, those are groups with names. They're called O, 4, 1 and O, 3, 2, respectively. And you can, if you consider the matrix, these matrices, just the matrices that are just infinitesimally different from the identity. So this is a common trick when you're trying to understand the structure of a group. You just look infinitesimally close to the identity. So you write one of these. You write each of these matrices, lambda AC, as the identity matrix plus an infinitesimal extra bit, and you plug in. You plug that into this equation and only keep terms up to linear order in omega. Then you'll see that this requirement boils down to the requirement that omega AB equals minus omega BA, where I've used this metric to lower the index on omega. So an omega AB, for example, is equal to eta AC omega CB. So the most general transformation that preserves that property looks infinitesimally close to the identity, like the identity plus an anti-symmetric 5x5 matrix. How many different independent parameters are there? Yeah.
I'm sorry. We got kind of lost.
I was going to show you. I was just going to show you that. Good question. That's a very important kind of lost. So the I have no idea where he's going kind of thing. I should have said where I was going. Thank you. Minkowski space has 10 symmetries. I just wanted to quickly show you that all of the maximally symmetric spaces have 10 symmetries. So De Sitter space and anti-De Sitter space have exactly the same symmetry, have exactly as much symmetry as Minkowski space, even though Minkowski space might at first glance seem simpler. So anyway, that's all I was going to say. If you count up the number of independent components of an anti-symmetric 5x5 matrix, or more generally an n by, you know, n plus 1 times n plus 1, then you'll find n plus 1 times n over 2 for De Sitter and anti-De Sitter space, and then alternatively, if you add up all the Lorentz transformations plus translations for Minkowski space, you get exactly the same answer. So these spaces always have this much symmetry, this many linearly independent ways that you can deform the space-time and get back exactly the same metric. So for example, for four-dimensional Minkowski space, four-dimensional De Sitter space, four-dimensional anti-De Sitter space, you're supposed to plug in n equals 4 here to get 10. For FRW spacetime, the only symmetry is the symmetry along the spatial surfaces. So you just use the same formula. You plug in n equals 3 now, just the spatial dimension. So these guys have six symmetries. You know, you can, and that's saying that the six symmetries physically are that in FRW spacetime, the universe around any individual observer looks isotropic, so he can rotate around any of his three coordinate axes and see a universe that looks exactly the same. Or he can translate along each of the three spatial directions around him and see a universe that looks exactly the same. So those are the symmetries of all of the FRW spacetimes. It's exactly the same regardless of whether they're open or closed or flat, k equals plus 1 or minus 1 or 0. But there's no symmetry in the time direction in the FRW spacetimes, right? And there's no freedom to boost, you know. So the FRW spacetimes, unlike Minkowski space, where one observer who chooses his time this way and his spatial slices this way, sees the same thing as another observer who chooses spatial slices this way and time this way. You know, not so for the FRW universe. If these surfaces are maximally symmetric and evolving in time in this guy's coordinates, in these other coordinates, you know, at constant time, over here there may be galaxies, whereas over here, you know, the universe is still filled with the quark gluon plasma or something like that. There's no analogous Lorentz. There's no analogous symmetry under boosts in FRW spacetime. And so then what are the symmetries of the black hole? Well, the Schwarzschild black hole, its symmetries are a translation in time. So it has one symmetry that FRW doesn't have, translation in time. And it has three symmetries that FRW does have, namely it's spherically symmetric about this one point at the origin. About r equals 0, it's spherically symmetric. So if you rotate the black hole about any of its three coordinate axes, you know, x, y, and z, the x, y, and z directions through the space-time, then the metric is invariant. But unlike FRW, there's no translational symmetry, right? There's a special point at r equals 0. You understand what I mean. The point r equals 0 is not the same as the point r not equal to 0, theta phi is equal to anything. There's a special point on each given surface, which is the singularity of the center of the black hole. The Kerr metric has this is the least symmetric guy we've encountered so far, and then the Kerr metric is even less symmetric. Which means that all expressions get a little bit more complicated every time you take away some symmetry. And so the Kerr metric is not spherically symmetric. You've started the thing spinning. It started off with the symmetries of Schwarzschild that you could do arbitrary rotations of the sphere or translate in time, but then you started the thing spinning, and that picked out a special direction, the direction around which the black hole is spinning, and so now it just has translation in time and rotations about that one direction. So it just has sort of two symmetries left over. It does not have general spherical symmetry. And so I mentioned that again. So first of all, just to give a sense of how these guys, that's kind of at the broadest brush, you know, maybe the important thing to remember about how these metrics relate to one another. Also to say that usually, once you know the number of symmetries of a spacetime, you can tell a bunch of things. You can tell sort of how many conserved quantities are associated with geodesics through that spacetime, and okay, which equations of mathematical physics, like the Maxwell equation for the electromagnetic field living on that spacetime, you know, will you be, how many times will it be separable? Will you be able to factor a general solution into a product of a bunch of solutions, each depending only on one coordinate, you know, like you do in to solve a lot of problems in electromagnetism? Often, by knowing the symmetries of the spacetime, you can tell how well that will go, how many conserved quantities, how much you'll be able to separate things. And so Kerr, among its many magical properties, is that it turned out that even though you thought it only had two symmetries, that it has more conserved quantities than you would expect. There's more conserved quantities than there are symmetries of the spacetime, and you can completely separate the equations of mathematical physics living on the field equations of, say, the electromagnetic field or the graviton field living on that spacetime, even though it appears naively that there isn't enough symmetry to do so. So Kerr is some crazy spacetime. But the last thing I just want to say is to maybe give a quick picture. So the picture of the Schwarzschild black hole is you know, very simple. It's just there's some spherical surface in the spacetime that sort of sweeps forward for all time. And if you're inside that surface, that's bad. And if you're outside that surface, that could be okay. So the point of this surface is there's nothing physical at that surface, but an observer, once an observer is inside, there's no hope of ever sending a light signal out through this surface to communicate with any guy out here, at least classically. So how does the spinning black hole look different from that? In short, if you keep the mass fixed and you spin up the black hole, then in the kind of coordinates that are most like these Schwarzschild coordinates, you find that as you spin it up, the radius of the black hole, the radius of the event horizon, shrinks from 2 GM to just 1 GM. And there's a maximum amount that you can spin it. If you try to spin the Kerr black hole, so you spin it faster and faster and faster, but in units where g is equal to c is equal to 1, the spin has units of mass squared. Angular momentum has the same units as mass squared. So it is believed that whenever you form a spinning black hole, that it always has s less than or equal to its mass squared, because if you try to spin it up beyond this, various things go horribly wrong. So one of those will be something that you'll think about in the tutorial problem. But it has this maximum spin. That's another sort of physically important thing to say about it. And then it also has, in addition to its event horizon, it also has something called an ergosphere, if it's spinning about the vertical axis here, the axis in the board. And so we're looking at it from the side. The ergosphere bows out. So in the equatorial plane of the black hole, the ergosphere is widest. Whereas if you're looking down at the black hole, you know, so it's spinning about this axis, then this is the event horizon, and then there's some ergosphere outside it. Is it clear? And what the ergosphere means, what the region in between the black hole and the, or actually this surface is called sometimes called the static limit, but the region in between is called the ergo region. And so that's a region that's sort of analogous to the event horizon, but it's like an event horizon in the angular direction. So in this region, let's say the black hole is spinning this way, then any particle, even a particle of light, also has to spin in that direction. If you try to fire a particle, if the black hole is spinning here and you try to fire a particle this way, so to put it in orbit around the black hole in the opposite direction, you will fail. It will be dragged in the direction that the black hole is spinning, just as if you tried to fire a particle outward when you're inside the horizon, you will fail and it will be pulled back inward by the intensity of the gravitational field. Yeah?
Of the ergosphere, if you shoot the light in the opposite direction, would it stay on the same spot?
If you shoot it in the angular direction, yeah, that's exactly right. So it's just analogous. If at this point you shoot it in, you don't shoot it in the right direction, but there is one direction that you can shoot it in, namely exactly opposite to the spin, where it will just linger. Yeah.
Isn't there some kind of a problem with that? That you can go outside the ergosphere and intercept the light ray with a net or something.
You can intercept it with a net?
Well, I don't know. You can go outside the ergosphere and there's some light just staying on the same spot, and then you can just catch up with it. So doesn't that have some kind of problem?
Well, you won't catch up. How would you won't catch up with it because if you try to approach it and you're anything less speedy than a light ray, you will be whipped, as you try to approach it, you'll be whipped around by the black hole. So at best, you'll run into the backside of that light ray.
But if you're outside, you don't have to travel faster than the speed of light to stay at the same spot.
At the same radius, you mean?
Yes.
That's right. So you can linger at the same radius, but if you're not a photon, you can't linger at that spot in theta. So while that photon is lingering, looking down here, the photon is lingering, and you want to go snare it with your net.
From the outside.
You're coming in with a net from over here, and you want to go fishing for that photon.
Yes.
Right. So what happens is you go, oh, I've almost got it, whoa, and then you run into it over here, which is the same as saying, but that's legal. That's just what happens. That's just you gotta get used to life being like that near a black hole. It's like every black hole fisherman. You just won't catch any photons until you get used to that basic fact of life. But I like that we had a net. That was a good image. Okay, so I think maybe that's all I want to say about that. And now let's do FRW. Okay, so because it didn't cost us anything except headaches, but no extra computational costs, I've been keeping the number of spatial dimensions arbitrary when I first talked about the FRW spacetimes. But let's just can that. Let's just be straight with one another. We appear to live in three dimensions, and for concreteness, you can always work things out for arbitrary n if you want. But from now on, I'm going to. After hopefully demonstrating to you that, because who knows, as you get early enough in the early universe, was the universe really effectively three-dimensional? I don't know. And I mean, if there was something before the Big Bang, which who knows, there could be. Was it effectively three-dimensional? I don't know. So you may, at some point in your life, enjoy the fact that all of these things. I hope I've impressed upon you that everything is sort of essentially identical for arbitrary n. But let's real world now. N equals 3. So so we had said that the metric for FRW. So the first thing I want. So what am I going to tell you now? In keeping with the trying to tell you where I'm going. We use these quasi-Cartesian coordinates to derive the metrics for the maximally symmetric spacetimes and for the FRW spacetimes. And for many reasons, those coordinates are nice for understanding what's going on, but they're not what you will see in cosmology papers and cosmology textbooks. They're sort of standard coordinates, and so I just want to tell you what those are now and how they relate. And then once I've done that, I will tell you, so first we're just going to quickly do coordinates, and then kinematics. So this means how to test particles, massless, massive, and massless test particles move through the spacetime, and what do the horizons look like? And then we'll get to dynamics. I doubt we'll get to it today, but so just how does the space-time itself respond when you put something besides a test particle into it, when you put in some stress energy, radiation or matter or something with energy density and pressure? Okay, so coordinates first. So we said the metric looked like, we had written the metric in this form. So now the first thing that I want to say is that without loss of generality, we can from now on take rho is equal to 1. And you know the way you see that is, let's see, I guess I want to make, so if I make the substitution that xe is equal to rho x twiddle e, and that a of t is equal to 1 over rho a twiddle of t. I just plug that in there. Then you can easily check that what you will see is exactly the same metric, but so right, two rows will come out of here, and you can also divide two rows out of here. Those will cancel with two rows up here. The two extra rows from here will cancel with the two extra 1 over rows from here. So you'll get the same metric, but with all of the x's replaced by x twiddles everywhere, all of the a's replaced by a twiddles, and rho is gone. Rho has just been replaced by 1. Okay, so just by rescaling the coordinates and rescaling a together, I can always choose the coordinates, these x's, to be the coordinates not just on the sphere of radius r, but on the unit sphere or on the unit hyperboloid. And again, we only need to do this. Rho only appears when k is plus or minus 1, right? Rho drops out altogether when k is 0. So I'm talking about when k is equal to plus or minus 1, there's a canonical choice for the scaling of the coordinates. So that from now on, we're going to set rho, so we're just going to drop the twiddles and set rho as equal to 1. So from now on, we'll assume that we've already gone through this exercise. I mean, you know, we've already rescaled the coordinates in this way. Yeah?
Is it in principle even possible to talk about this kind of stuff without referring to any specific coordinates, like in a coordinate-free way?
Well, With some things, definitely yes. With some things, yes, and with some things, no. And then often with the some things, yes, not in an easy way, given what I've introduced so far. But so, for example, an example of that will come when we get to discussing the memento and how they evolve. I mean, so ultimately all physical statements about the spacetime should. I mean, this is like a the basic answer to your question is that anything physical that you want to say about the spacetime should be independent of what coordinates you choose. Yeah, that said, for a lot of things, it is convenient to choose a particular coordinate system. Maybe that will be a little bit more concrete when, for example, I'm thinking that. So, that's an extremely vague answer. Let me go ahead and try to mention some more concrete things as Walter goes. The first thing that you will encounter is just that people switch from Cartesian these quasi Cartesian spatial coordinates to spherical coordinates, just like you usually would for Cartesian coordinates. Okay, and so if you want, you can check. It's easy to check that if you make this substitution, that the line element gets changed. From here, you get a dr squared and an r squared d phi. From that bit, you get an r squared and r squared d omega squared, where this is the metric on the two sphere, the metric for the sort of theta phi part of the metric. And then here you get k. You can check that what comes out is minus dt squared plus and then, so that's one standard radial coordinate. So people always work in spherical coordinates, but there's two possible radii that they use. One is this guy R, but the other guy is, if you make the substitution, R is S sub k of chi, where I'm defining this function S sub k of chi to be sine of chi, sinh of chi, or just chi, depending on whether k is plus 1, minus 1, or 0. So if you plug that in here, this term just becomes d chi squared. And this term, of course, just becomes this function s sub k squared of chi times d omega squared. And so what geometrically do these two radii r and chi mean? So remember, for example, let's take the case of k of plus 1. So that means that the spatial surface looks like a 3-sphere, and it's a unit 3-sphere, remember? So I'm just going to draw the 2-sphere, if you'll permit that. And remember, in the case of the two-sphere, the original quasi-Cartesian coordinates here were the coordinates x1 and x2 in the plane here. So this was the extra direction, the xn plus 1 that we eliminated. And then, do people understand what this picture means? Or no? This circle, this equatorial circle, is supposed to lie in the same plane as these two orthogonal Cartesian coordinates, x1 and x2. Is that? And then r is just the radial coordinate along the direction of the plane. So I live on the surface of this sphere. This is the point r equals 0. And if I go out to a point over here, r is this radial distance calculated using the planar coordinates. Right? x1 squared plus x2 squared, that's r in this direction. I'm suppressing the third coordinate. So r is this thing. Okay? But alternatively, you could measure r. Arguably, a more physical thing to do if you're an observer living in this space-time is to measure the radius along the space-time, and that's chi. Okay, so if you can check that's just the transformation that we did. So you can see that if you're an observer at the origin and you're asking what is your spatial distance to another guy further and further away here on the unit sphere, as he gets all the way over here, this guy is a distance r equals 1 away from you, but he's a distance chi is pi over 2 away. Okay? And then the Cartesian coordinates and also the spherical coordinates with this guy are, we said, I don't know if you remember, but last time we said that, you know, you can see that a given set of Cartesian coordinates in the plane does not uniquely, you know, it corresponds to two different points on the sphere, the point directly above and the point directly below. So that means those coordinates only cover, as Tibber pointed out, the top half of the sphere. And that's same with this r variable, because, you know, a given r theta phi labels both this point and also this point. But with chi, it's not true. With chi, you can just keep letting it run. And this is chi equals 0 up here. This is chi equals pi over 4. Chi equals pi over 2. But then you can just keep going. This is 3 pi over 4. And then the maximum value that it can reach is just pi. Okay, so these coordinates, in addition to being arguably more physical, they also cover the whole space-time. There's no for the hyperboloid, there's no analogous problem. For the open universe, because you kind of only wanted you only your universe presumably. It's true that the coordinates that our construction gave two hyperboloids, a hyperboloid up here and a hyperboloid down here, if you remember. As presumably, our universe is just one of these hyperboloids, and so you only need your coordinates to cover one half. Yeah.
There's one comment may be relevant here. Is that when the universe is a hyperbola, the hyperboloid is also maximally symmetric space.
Right.
Although when we draw it, it looks like there's a special point.
Yeah,
that's an artifact of the fact that we're embedding it in three-dimensional Euclidean space.
Yeah, four-dimensional Euclidean space.
So.
Yeah, that's absolutely true. Right, so, yeah. So if you rotated this guy, you would see the same sphere. If you did a boost, or a rotation about the central axis, you can see that you will get the same thing. Because hyperboloids are conserved under boosts. They just take one point in hyperbola to another point in hyperbola. Okay. So those are the two different radial coordinates that you should sort of understand. And then the other important thing is that it's common to switch from t, which is the cosmic time, or the or another thing that we'll eventually see that it is the proper time as measured by a co-moving observer. An observer is just sort of at rest with respect to the Hubble flow, with respect to the expansion of the universe. But we can introduce a new coordinate, d eta, which is called the conformal time. So now you can integrate this differential relation. So Catherine, where are you? You can integrate. So if you substitute that here, it pulls out an overall factor of A. So the metric now looks like minus dA squared, d eta squared, plus d chi squared, plus so this is called the conformal time because the scale factor A now multiplies the whole metric and acts on it all in the same way. And when you have an overall multiplicative factor that is not necessarily constant, that multiplies the whole remainder of the metric in a common way, that's called a conformal factor. So that's why this thing's that's where the origin of the name conformal time is for eta. And so you can integrate, you know, if you're originally given A of t and you want to know, what I'm trying to say is that let's suppose you originally have your metric and your scale factor in terms of the time t, and you want to know what is this eta that you speak of and what does my scale factor look like as a function of eta, then you would say, well, d eta is just equal to the integral, eta. You would integrate both sides of this to find that eta minus eta at some fiducial time is equal to the integral from t, that same fiducial time, but expressed in the different coordinate, t naught up to t, of dt over a of t. So if I gave you a function a of t, you can perform this integral. You end up with eta as a function of t. And so then if you invert that, if you invert that expression to get t as a function of eta, and you substitute t as a function of eta into a of t, you know that's a of eta. That's how you would figure out what a is as a function of the new coordinate eta. And of course, you could alternatively do the reverse thing. If you started off in eta conformal time coordinates and you knew your scale factor a as a function of the conformal time eta, you just do the inverse process. Now you do the integral with the a on the other side. Oh, I'll just write it. So instead, you would integrate that relation directly. You would have a of eta here, and so you would see t minus fiducial t is integral from eta naught to eta d eta times a of eta. Okay, so you're free to go back and forth between these two guys. You just have to do an integral. So I think that's maybe all I have to say about coordinates. You now know them like the back of your hand. So each of these guys is useful for different purposes. But let me now go. I guess I have 10 minutes, 10 or 15 minutes. Okay, so now let's see how particles. It's kind of too late to salvage that, right? So. So what do particles do? The first key thing is that. Well, this has no page 2. Oh, it does have a page 2. So, suppose we wrote down the geodesic equation for this space time. So remember, the geodesic equation looks like u mu delta mu. Maybe I'll stick to the notation in the No, it's U alpha is equal to zero, or U is dx alpha d tau. If the particle is moving along some trajectory, x alpha of tau. Now, usually, so tau is often the name used to denote the proper time along the world line of a massive particle. But so the proper time vanishes; it does not evolve for a photon. But you can use but nevertheless there is still a so-called affine parameter. You can still parameterize the curve that it moves along. It's just not the parameter that you use is just not the proper time ticked off by a clock being held by the photon or whatever you want to say. So instead the way you define that affine parameter is you say if you're talking about a photon, you take it let's call its affine parameter lambda. We define lambda, we normalize lambda such that the tangent vector to that curve is the four momentum of the photon moving along that curve. So remember, the curve doesn't select the four momentum of the photon. Like you can along the same, like if I fire a photon, an X-ray, and a very high frequency photon and a very low frequency photon at the same moment from the same point in space, they will travel along exactly the same geodesic and space-time. But throughout that process, if photon one initially had 10 times the momentum and energy of photon two in some coordinate system, then at all subsequent points that will still be true. And that's just saying that the definition of this, that even though you're talking about the same geodesic through space-time, that for those two different photons, the rate at which this lambda, defined in this way, ticks off will be 10 times as fast. The parameter along the curve will move 10 times as quickly, even though it's the same curve. Just the parameterization will be different for the photon of one momentum and the photon of the other momentum. And now, for a massive particle, it has a four momentum, which is equal to m times its four velocity. And its four velocity is the tangent to the curve with respect to its proper time. But so since I just want to derive for you one result that is valid for both photons, for both massless particles and massive particles, just to treat them in a common way, I can just define for a massive particle the parameter lambda to be by d lambda equals d tau, its proper time, over m. And now this equation is true for both massless and massive particles. And so the geodesic equation, then, written in that language, now the mu equals I components of this equation are not so important. Let's look at the mu equals zero component of the equation. Okay, so how the p zero is the energy of the particle. Now we derived in a previous lecture that the Christoffel symbol in the FRW metric, it's zero. The Christoffel symbol with upper index 0 vanishes unless both of the lower indices are not 0. Okay, so this has to be I and this has to be J. And in that case, it is equal to the Christoffel symbol is equal to H, which again is just A dot over A, times the spatial metric. And so since we're okay, so this equation becomes dp0 d lambda plus h gij pi pj. But now gij pi pj that is the physical magnitude squared of the spatial momentum. That's like if you know if you're a guy moving in the time direction but sitting at a fixed spatial coordinate x, and you have a little detector and some photon runs into your detector and deposits some momentum, some magnitude in your detector, the magnitude squared of that momentum that you will report in your paper is this thing. So I'm going to call that capital curly P squared. But then the equation for a massive particle, I mean, the equation that is valid for both a massless particle or a massive particle is that the square of its four momentum, its two copies of its four momentum contracted with the metric. Can people see this? That's a Lorentz invariant thing. What Lorentz invariant quantity is it equal to? It is equal to the mass of the particle. So this is just the relation, the relativistic energy relation that you know from special relativity. This is E equals m squared plus the spatial momentum squared. But so in this context, it says if you plug in the FRW metric here, but for any spatial coordinate. So and again, the emergence of any spatial this would be an example of a thing where the coordinate dependence is dropping out as we get closer to a physical quantity. Because so in other words, this is capital, what we're calling capital curly P squared. And capital curly P squared is invariant under coordinates and under change of coordinates, under change of spatial coordinates. And the reason I don't have freedom to change spatial coordinates into time coordinates is because this is the magnitude of the spatial momentum as measured by a physical observer, namely the observer who moves along these preferred threads through the space-time, the threads where he preserves his position, what we'll call the co-moving, measured by a co-moving observer. But so that statement is now circular because I was about to explain to you what a co-moving observer is. So cancel that statement. So the point now is that if you take the differential of both sides, the differential of this side is 0 because it's a constant, you get p naught dp naught is equal to curly p d curly p. Using that, you eliminate dp naught here in favor of d curly p. And then you find that you end up with a, when you use this equation to eliminate dp naught, you also end up with a p naught on the bottom, but p naught is defined as dt d lambda, so the d lambda cancels that d lambda. So at the end of the day, what you end up with is d curly p dt times p, and then the other term is what it was, h curly p squared. So let me let me move this guy over to the other side. So in other words, I'll write this equals with a minus sign, and I'll divide by a factor of curly P on both sides. I'll divide by two factors of curly P on both sides. This is not good board algebra. And then I'll multiply by a factor of dt on both sides. So remember, h was dA dt over A. So when I multiply by dt on both sides, it becomes dA over A. So now I integrate both sides of this equation, and it says log P, log curly P, is equal to minus log A plus some constant. But that, if I take the exponential of both sides, that just says curly P is proportional to 1 over A. And so this is the key result that I want to end with. And we'll probably just say a few more words about this the next time. But this is really key. This is one thing that's good to remember. For a massive particle, the fact that that curly P, the magnitude of its spatial momentum, goes away as A increases. The fact that as the universe expands and A increases, curly P drops to zero, that's saying that if I fire a particle across the universe, so it's initially moving fast relative to the spatial coordinates, that as the universe expands, it will begin to move slower and slower relative to the spatial coordinates that it's passing, until it comes to rest with respect to the spatial coordinates that we've been talking about. And so for that reason, and furthermore, as a special case, if I started at rest with respect to the spatial coordinates, if I started with 0, 3 velocity relative to the spatial coordinates, it will remain at 0, 3 velocity relative to the spatial coordinates. So for that reason, the observer, these coordinates are called co-moving because the particle eventually, even if you fire it with a non-zero initial 3 velocity, it comes to rest with respect to these coordinates. So the particles are said to be co-moving with the coordinates, and the special particles that have precisely 0 velocity with respect to the coordinates are called the co-moving observers. They're these special observers in the space-time. And the coordinates, because they co-move with the co-moving observers, are called co-moving coordinates. On the other hand, for massless particles, this same equation, the energy is equal to the magnitude of the momentum for a photon, which is equal to h bar omega. So this is saying that for a massless particle, the expansion of the universe doesn't bring it to rest relative to the co-moving coordinates. It always continues to move at the speed of light. But it's frequent, but it still feels this so-called Hubble drag effect, the same quote-unquote Hubble drag that made the massless particle come to rest with respect to the co-moving coordinates, affects a massless particle by causing it to redshift, by causing its frequency to drop, its energy to drop, and its wavelength to stretch. So that's maybe the easiest way to remember it, that as the universe stretches, the wavelength of a given photon just stretches in proportion with the stretching of the universe. This is an observed thing. So I mean, this is kind of the first way that we learned that the universe was expanding, is that Hubble in the 1920s looked out at galaxies, looked out at various distant objects, and saw that he could see spectral features. He could see that in the received light, as a function of frequency, there were certain emission, sudden narrow emission lines as a function of frequency, or narrow absorption lines as a function of frequency. And he realized those emission and absorption lines that he was seeing were nothing but the emission and absorption lines corresponding to transitions of atoms that he was looking at, but they weren't at the wavelength that he expected them to be at. They all seemed to be shifted to longer wavelengths, that is to say, shifted towards in the red direction, colloquially, relative to the same spectral lines if you measured them in a laboratory on Earth. And the more distant the object that he looked at, the larger was this effect. So, yeah, I mean, so, well, that's maybe so. So I'll end there. next. But what a week, right? We learned all of general relativity, all of differential geometry, all of Yang-Mills theory. You learned every space-time you'll ever need to know about, and now you know the FRW metric. We should just take next week off. Oh, I'm going to forget for a second lecture in a row to tell a Russian joke. So this is now playing no role since the lecture is over. So it's just me indulging myself. But so there's a character, but you might say it's introduction to next week because there are a lot of jokes involving the character Vovichka. Vovichka is like this little kid who's not, well, so the first joke introduces Vovichka. His mother is called into school one day, and she comes to the principal's office, and the principal is very upset, and she says, your son is in the last door at the end of the hall. And so she says, oh, okay. And so she walks down the hall, and first there's a door that says, you know, children who have been naughty. And she looks in, but no. So she keeps going. That's not the last door. And next she gets to the next door, which is actually naughty children. You know, which, you know, means a different thing. It's like more of a state of being. And then she goes to the next door, and it says wicked children. And she's, you know. And then the next door says irredeemably wicked children, and then future criminals, and then there's the final door that says Vovichka. Anyway, so I hope to have a few Vovichka jokes next week. I have to. Anyway, yeah, that's it.